So who wants to run it?
It's probably me since I've been doing it. I don't care, though. Georgia 2.
You're Georgia 2. All right. Looks like you, we're the two Florida people. So
okay, well,
about.
That's fine. Join us.
And we were just about a stone's throw from Georgia.
Well, you weren't far from Savannah, and that's where I was, so we'll start there.
Yeah, we weren't. We sure weren't.
That will help. I'm Boyd Faust, and I'm serving as facilitator of the Georgia 2 group, unless I can convince someone else to do that.
Not the Florida John.
Apparently,
anyway.
Apparently not.
Is that on?
Yes. We'll start by going around the table. You state your name and what county you worked in. Okay? And then we will talk about whatever we want to talk about, since I don't see it on here that says. Oh, here are the topics.
That's this afternoon.
Yeah, I think basically this morning what we're going to talk about as we talk is what the freedom movement meant to us. It's a 5-minute sharing of experiences in the movement and how it has led to the development of our later lives and things like that. I think that's what they're looking for. So as we start, we'll go around the table. I'll start and we'll go to my right. If you say your name and where you worked, no more than 15 seconds, please. And then we will start addressing that topic. Okay? Everybody ready? Okay, my name is Boyd Faust. In the summer of 65, I started working in Savannah, Chatham County, Georgia. Was moved by Hosea to Americus in mid-July and was in Americus through the end of the month. Spent a month in the Freedom House and then joined the SCLC staff to work in Hopewell, Virginia.
My name is Maxim Rice. I worked in Dublin, and that's Lawrence County, Georgia, for the summer of 65.
Well, my name is Joseph Cooney, and I worked in Talava County, that's Crawfordville, Georgia, in the summer of 65 and 66.
My name is Lovie Marie Gilliatt. I'm his spouse.
You need to speak up, I think, to reach the... Ma'am?
Oh, I'm Selena Kiesecker, Joe Kiesecker's wife, and I'm a part of this because I'm married to him.
All right, good.
I'm Elizabeth Jesse, then Darlene Keeler when I was there, and I worked in Fort Valley, Peach County, Georgia, the summer of 65.
My name's John Hetlinger, and I went to Madison County, Florida, in the summer of 1965. I had many experiences, including testifying in federal court about the beating up of one of our Freedom House members, and I had life-changing experiences there, and I've been involved in voter registration ever since.
I'm Joe Kiesecker, also in Madison, Florida, in 65 with SCOPE.
I'm Iris Rubin, and I worked with Boyd in Savannah in Chatham County. And also in Americus, when we got sent to Americus. And then from the end of 65 through August of 66, I worked in a SNCC MFDP project in Columbia, Mississippi, which is Marion County.
I think this is a good time to say we really need to speak up, not only because of the microphone, but also because some people around the table can't hear.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I'm Dallas Lindgren. I was in Fort Valley, Peach County, for most of the summer, and then I was in the Freedom House in Atlanta for 2 or 3 weeks.
I'm not part of the discussion.
Yeah, you are.
Yes, you are.
My name's Ray Walker. I'm married to Elizabeth Jesse. Okay. She was a worker in 65, and just here for support.
Okay.
My name's Nancy Rice. I'm married to Max, who is the SCOPE worker.
So it looks like we have people from Chatham County and Lawrence County and Madison County, Florida, and also Peach County, the people who were at Fort Valley. Okay, that was the University of Minnesota group.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. So I think the issue is, how did the experience of the Scope Summer affect our future lives? And I don't know that it's helpful necessarily to go around a circle. Maybe people will want to say whenever they want to, maybe one time till everyone has had a chance to speak. Would someone like to start with that discussion? All right, well, then I'll start with it, I suppose.
Will you say your name?
Yes, my name is Boyd Faust.
When everyone...
Thank you, everyone. And this is a reminder, when you start to speak, please say your name, because the transcriber won't know that. My name is Boyd Faust. I actually was born and raised in Macomb, Mississippi. So Joe Freeman and I have the distinct honor, I suppose, of being the two people here who were physically run out of the state of Mississippi by the State Sovereignty Commission. But I was in Macomb during the COFO summer of 1964, and this was a very formative time for me, and it's what led me into Scope. Macomb was the bombing capital of the world in that particular summer. And Hosea always liked to call me his white boy from Mississippi, which was fine with me. I didn't care. I was originally sent to Savannah, and Iris and I served there together, along with 10 other people, some of whom have passed away, others of whom are simply not able to be here today, so we're the only two from Savannah. In mid-July, we were transferred, the two of us were transferred to Americus because Americus was beginning to heat up. This is right at the time the women were arrested in the Justice of the Peace election in Americus that led to the whole Americus issue. I was there until I was clubbed by a highway patrolman at the Quick Check supermarket one balmy Saturday afternoon. The 31st of July, sent back to Atlanta and was kept in the Freedom House, not because I was really that hurt, but because I was a white boy from Mississippi who had been injured by a Georgia cracker, and it made for great headlines for the Scope Project, so I was sort of kept out of sight during that period. And then at the end of the summer, I went to Hopewell as a staff person. When I first came to the South, I came because it was something I felt like I needed to do. I was at the University of Notre Dame at the time, and I felt like I needed to do something. Maybe it was a guilt for being a white Mississippian after the previous summer. I'm not really sure anymore. It's too long ago. But I came thinking I need to do something. And I was the only person from that university. Iris was the only person from Temple. And so that's how this group got put together. Unlike the Peach County group and the Macon group, we didn't come as a part of a big project. Okay? And so we came, we were sent there. Probably we were asked whether we wanted to go. I don't remember.
I don't think so.
But we were sent there. It was Hosea's hometown. And it was his pride and joy. But then as Americus began to flare up, we were sent there. And I think that was a very subtle thing in my life after the project. Once I went home, I went back to school, and I started thinking about the experiences I'd had there. Nobody had ever hit me with a billy club before. And I was really stunned at the kind of reaction. You know, I was the stupid kid. I was 21, but I was still the stupid kid who, seeing other people being attacked by those white folks over there outside the supermarket, went up to a Georgia patrolman and asked him if he wasn't going to do something about it.
No.
And so he did. Boink. And so, you know, I was spirited. Ben Clark, I don't know if any of you remember Benjamin Van Clark, but Ben Clark is the one who got me out of there and took me back to Barnum Funeral Home, which was sort of the center for the Scope Project at that time. And I think I learned to be a little less stupid then, and a little less naive, perhaps. I think that was really formative. I began to understand how to look at things and how to view what was happening around me. And though I didn't go back to the South again, I I had a different attitude toward the world that was around me, and I think I've always had that. And I'm going to stop there. That's almost time, and I will let somebody else talk now. Please state your name and where you served when you speak.
I'm Joe Kiesecker. At Christmas or New Year's time of 64-65, I was at National Student Christian Federation Conference gathering in Ohio, and there were a couple of people there recruiting for the freedom for the summer I'm sorry, 63-64. They were recruiting for the Freedom Summer in Mississippi. It was James Bevel and Andrew Young. And so that's where I interviewed, and that's where I committed to go. And so I spent the summer in the first half in Madison County, second half in Leake County in Mississippi, the summer of 64, which shaped my thinking, my convictions for the rest of my life in many ways. That next school year, I was a senior in college, small liberal arts college in Emporia, Kansas, College of Emporia, and was involved in some civil rights work there at the school. We organized to try to get fair housing policy for off-campus housing and various things, and we organized a sympathy demonstration march for the Selma March, along with students from Kansas State Teachers College at Emporia, it was called then, and we organized a group to prepare to come with the scope in the summer of 65. And we wound up with, I think, five of us from Emporia altogether. I was the only one from our college. We had three from the Emporia State, we called it, and one right out of high school, John. And the experiences in Madison, Florida, I thought, wow, we got an assignment to Florida. We got a cushy one.
Yeah.
No. Madison, Florida is kind of an extension of Southeast Georgia. extremely tough and rough on people. We got there and we found our local leader, a young black man by the name of David Dukes, which he was always careful to really pronounce the S. he was 18 years old. He was already a veteran. He'd been in jail a few times. He'd been in court. He'd been challenged and struck a few times. He became a very important leader for us, and he lived with us in a Freedom House. We didn't live with families, but in a Freedom House together. And at our height, I guess we had eight people in there, right? Eight or nine. Some others joined us during the course of the summer. We worked on voter registration, worked on desegregating public facilities. John has more to say about that than I do in terms of experience, for sure. But the movie theater, some other things. One of our people took a bad beating during the summer. Everybody had experiences of confrontation, of course, of various kinds. We had a memorable chase at one point in what we called the Scope Mobile. You'll see pictures on the wall of an old 54 Ford that we drove down from Emporia, Kansas. And we used that during the summer. And we got chased by local, whatever they were called in Florida, would have been a white citizen council in Mississippi.
Yeah, yeah.
But whoever they were. Tried to chase us out into the country and didn't succeed. But so we had those kinds of experiences. That whole series of things very much shaped the rest of my life. Back in Chicago is where I went after that, to theological seminary, and was involved in community organizing in Chicago in multiracial ethnic communities.
What year?
I was there started in the fall of 65, graduated in 69, was involved in Gary, Indiana, in voter registration when Richard Hatcher ran, was the first black mayor elected there. Some memorable experiences there. Some people said, well, it's not quite Mississippi. I said, you don't bet on it. we were there, of course, in 68 with the riots, and helped out with some housing and some other things in relation to people from the areas. And all the rest of our lives, we've been involved in work with civil rights, human rights, in this country, in Guatemala some, and now working with issues related to immigration, living in Arizona as we do.
I will be next. I'm John Hettlinger, and I am from Emporia, Kansas. That's where I was when I met Joe, and Joe was the old guy. I was the young kid at the time, 17 years old, so I actually had to lie and say, oh, I'm 18, because you had to be 18 to be involved in this particular program, but nobody seemed to mind too much. My dad was a professor at Emporia State Teachers College, and we'd lived in Emporia for a while. I guess I didn't know all those problems that Joe just talked about. They might have gone right over my head. I started in 1960 passing out campaign cards and going door to door for John Kennedy during the presidency, and that kind of started me off. So those few years later, when he was assassinated, that was a big thing to me, and it just followed through when 1965 came and these activities and voter registration came up. I thought, well, I ought to be involved. And so I was one of those people that went down to Madison. I didn't go in the initial car. I went with another fellow, a black guy, and the interesting thing about it was, as we drove along and would have to get gas, why, he would stop the car, I'd get out, he'd go down to gas station, get gas, and drive back and get me, because the idea was you were not going to be seen together with a black guy and a white guy in a single car sitting together. We got to Madison, Florida, and here we were in Freedom House. First time I'd ever been out on my own, so to speak, and so it was kind of an interesting experience from that standpoint. I remember going down to the dime store initially there and getting something and sticking out my hand to get the change from the cashier, and she just took the change and just threw it down on the counter because, again, no one was going to touch my hand because I was involved with the voter registration activities. We took a lady, 104 years old, I recall very well. I think there may be a picture somewhere around here, down to register to vote. May have been the first time she'd ever been in the Madison County Courthouse, but when you walk in, there you see all of the colored-only, white-only drinking fountains and doors. Well, these were things a kid from Emporia, Kansas, 17 years old, had never seen or never quite experienced. Joe talked about the chase scene. This is the kind of a show-and-tell. Joe's quite a writer, and he has a great article here that he wrote that was published in our local paper in Emporia, and my dad put together this little information about the story, and thankfully Joe is a good driver, and we ended up safe, but it was a situation where we were targeted. We had been targeted. Crowbars, this was going to be a serious situation, but we made it. There was another time when night after night, well, one night the trucks came down in front of the house and beating on the sides of them, hollering, and then the gunshots fired off, so we called the FBI. I have pretty good feelings about the FBI at the time. The FBI actually stopped me on the street and said wanted me to come over to their car one afternoon and get in. I said, well, I'm not getting in any car with a couple of white guys. Let me see your identification. So they showed me. And actually, this is one of the tales that I have to tell because I went to work for the FBI. I guess that's what you'd call it. They got me to, I got a car that was a Tennessee license plate on it and went out to a place called Cherry Lake. And it had been famous for for its segregated policies. And when I went up there and pretended like I was real hot and tired. I've been driving all day. I told the people at the gate that just doggone, it's too bad I can't get in because it's all private now. Oh, no, it's not private. We're just keeping those people out of here. And so I did go swimming, and then on the way out, he said, well, goodbye, goodbye. And I said, yeah, well, I may see you again. And eventually I did see the man again in federal court when I testified against Cherry Lake. Here I was sitting there at recess one of the afternoons on the bench in the hall by myself, and these four big fellas came up and said, you're never going to get back to Kansas alive. We're going to kill you. And I suppose, being kind of a smart-mouthed little kid, I might have said something to him about coming to Kansas, and, you know, we'll see, but I'm not sure if I actually did. It was a scary situation. I also did take pictures. This was before we had all our cell phones and such, but I took pictures of the beating of Bill Bigelow by the chief of police, Cherry, and those pictures were also put into the record as part of my testimony in federal court. And that was an eventful summer, and the things we've heard today about voter registration, and I believe too, we're going backward, and it's a shame as to what's happening in our country. And I believe too that we need to work on changing these laws, but I think that means electing people that will make the difference. And so it's always comes down to voting and being responsible. And I hope that those are the things that will change. Thank you.
What is your name?
John Hetlinger, and I'm from Shawnee, Kansas.
Boyd Faust is facilitator again. We have a new person who's joined our group. We began by saying our name and where we served during the summer, if you would do that for us.
My name is Betty Harris, and I was living in Crawfordville, Georgia at the time of the movement, and my father and mother were fired from their positions, teaching positions. My father was the principal. Yes. So I was invited here. I know a few people from
Thank
Stokes.
You. Who wants to be next? Fight for it.
Hand it. I'm Dallas Lindgren. And I was one of a group of 21 students from Minnesota that went to Fort Valley, Georgia. We were the largest group sponsored by a school.
The Minnesota Fat Cats is what we were called.
That I didn't know. Okay. I worked mostly with the voter registration and the literacy classes. And I was very proud of the fact that the literacy classes that we established there, working with women in the community as the teachers, lasted until early December, I heard. So we were just there in the summer, and something we did for that continued. And we registered a number of people, the number I don't remember. We, too, lived in a Freedom House to start with. Our office was also in an old mortuary, which seemed to be a custom. I don't know why. It was sort of creepy. We had freedom schools for the children. And when I was going through my records, I discovered a pile of pictures that the children had done. And I brought those with me.
Oh, wonderful.
To try and show at some point during this, like about 12 or 15 of them, they were given the words, freedom is, and then they had to draw a picture of that. But the literacy work that I did there stayed with me all my life. And so eventually, when I retired, I started a second career as teaching English as a foreign language to adult immigrants. And most of our students in Fort Valley had been middle-aged to elderly women who were illiterate. And I was so struck by that, that then when I was in my 50s, I went back to working with older people who were illiterate or who did not know English. And so, you know, that's sort of weird continuation. Also in my work, I was at the Minnesota Historical Society, and when I worked in the education part, we developed curriculum units on Minnesota history, one of which was on the Ojibwe people, which is one of the two major tribes in Minnesota. So I was involved with sort of the same type of organizing, where we worked with an Ojibwe committee to produce curriculum materials for the for grades 4 through 12. So I'm really pleased to be here. I brought my daughter, who has heard about this all her life, and she asked, well, I want to go too. So, okay, so she came.
Great.
At the moment, she's up in her room or in the coffee shop working on her dissertation, but she'll be joining us again later.
Where in Minnesota are you?
I'm from St. Paul.
St. Paul, great.
Right.
She's like, Max.
My name is Maxim Rice. I grew up on a farm in Michigan, and so I was pretty naive about the whole civil rights idea. I went to college, got an engineering degree, and started work at a research laboratory north of Detroit. But in December of 1964, I went to the 8th Quadrennial Conference of the Methodist Student Movement. Lo and behold, Martin Luther King was there and spoke. And I think that was the impetus that set me on my present journey. March of 65, I and several other people from my former university went down and marched in the last day of the Selma March into Montgomery. And it was clear at that point that I was not really cut out to be an engineer all my life. So in June of that year, 65, I quit my job and headed south and got the orientation for the SCOPE project. I was assigned to Lawrence County, Georgia, Dublin, and myself and Carol Johnson, who's here, and Linda Donati, who could not make it, and Norm Hodges, who has passed away since then. We were all down there. We were directed by the head of the NAACP in Dublin by the name of Reuben Gamble, a wonderful man, and he died several years ago. But the youth group of the NAACP were really the people that we were working with directly and who really kind of came up with the ideas of what we were doing. And one of the more momentous occasions that I remember, obviously, was that the kids thought that they were invited to come to the evening service of the local white First Baptist Church. Mm-hmm. It turned out to be an erroneous message, but we went anyway. The police and lots of Christians were outside blocking the way. And so we were herded back, and all of a sudden there was a whole group of white people around us. And somebody threw some kind of a caustic substance, in, which got on several of the girls there, and they were going hysterical, and a little of it hit me. And then someone grabbed me and started beating me, beating me into the ground. While the police just stood there and watched. In fact, I think it was a police billy club that they had taken. I was taken to the hospital, the local hospital, and it turned out to be the white hospital. So after they had got me on the gurney and ready to do something, they put my clothes back on and put me back in the ambulance and took me to the county hospital, which is where the black people go. I had 22 stitches in my head. And a mild concussion, some cracks in the fingers. After that, it really, frankly, energized the kids, the youth. They really got to cracking on their organizing. And they did all kinds of things, like tried to get people to actually be hired in the local Winn-Dixie, which is where all the black people went to buy their groceries, but they had no black employees. The same thing with the local cleaners, gas stations, all that kind of thing. So for me, we worked out the last months of the project, and we did actually register quite a few black folks. But after that, I was on a spiritual journey, right? And so I went to Candler School of Theology at Emory University that fall. One more minute?
Yep.
And And then over the years, I did finish the master's degree in theology. I started then to be much more aware of the Vietnam War. We started doing war tax resistance. I met my wife in seminary and married her. She's here with me. And from that time on, we've been doing a lot of organizing, setting up new communities and that kind of thing. And we're still working on it.
I was wondering if I could.
Yes, please. Yep.
Thanks. I was 12 years, Betty Harris, I was 12 years old at the time my parents and four other teachers were fired from Merton High Elementary and High School. And I asked my parents if I could join the movement. I didn't think they would. Crawfordville, Georgia.
Crawford.
Yes, Tolliver County. Okay, sorry, I'm a professor. I should be able to speak loudly. So my parents allowed me to get involved, so I was on the picket line. I remember Father Cooney very well. He was quite a figure in the Crawfordville movement. So I was picketing. Bonner's Cafe became a private club, so it was a similar situation to the one that you described. And we also integrated Alexander Stevens State Park, going there to swim every weekday, and had mass meetings every Sunday and would march into town, and people like Ralph Abernathy, Hosea Williams, C.T. Vivian would all come on those Sundays for demonstrations. They hired the first black policeman in Crawfordville at that time. Not only was he the first... Was he the first in Georgia? Not only was he the first black policeman, but the first with a disability that might impair his ability to do his job. He only had one arm. And someone was always whispering to him as he went around the streets, but he didn't really do any harm to anyone. And so there, a person who was there, who was underage, was a guy named James Gibson. He was from Marietta, I think. And, you know, James was about 3 years older than me, and we would talk. And one day I arrived to picket, and James wasn't there. So I said, "Where is James?" He said his parents found out he was here and came and picked him up. And maybe 3 or 4 days later, James reappeared, and he never left, you know, until the end of the summer. There was quite a bit of violence. Crawfordville was my father's hometown, and he and my mother had come to Crawfordville 2 years before because he was invited back to be the principal of the school. And my grandfather owned a large farm outside of Crawfordville. And so, you know, I was, as a 12-year-old, was sort of oblivious to what was happening with my parents, but I wanted to be involved in the movement. And I was treated very well to be the youngest person there. You know, I would walk just as much as anyone else and was very active in the process. But some of the white businessmen became very agitated about, picketing. And I remember... Hal Frazier Richards, whose wife was the probate judge or whatever they call it here in Georgia, and he was drunk one day and came down through the picket line. And another prominent citizen knocked a friend, a male friend, in front of me off the street. And Bob Hurd put out a message on Facebook about a little girl who asked him to... if he would hold her hand so that she'd go back out and join the demonstration. So it was one of those events, a guy being knocked down or a drunken man coming through, or one of the Hubbard brothers parking a backhoe on the street. Well, he saw us, he hollered, "UNs, get off the street before I come back." When he came back with the bat and parked the backhoe, we ran. And so that's the thing with nonviolence. You don't want to die. You could think about being, you know, taken under. The FBI, I thought, were not really functioning in Crawfordville. They would always show up after someone had knocked people down and left. And they were very rude when they did come. One Sunday at the mass demonstration, there was a man, I think his name was T.C. Harrington. He owned a shoe shop near the black section of town where we met to get our signs and everything. And so he was doing a lecture on creationism, and I as a child didn't know. I had to figure it out later that that was what he was lecturing on. And so my father went off one day. The three of us were home, the three sisters, three daughters, and the sheriff came to our house. And we didn't go to the door. And when my father returned a few minutes later, we told him the sheriff had been there. And he took us on country roads to my grandmother's house and left us. My mother at the time was working on her master's at the University of Georgia and commuting. And so she came home to find an empty house, no message or anything. So she drove to my grandmother's house and picked us up, and we didn't know where my father was. But I don't know, Father Cooney, if you knew, but we didn't know where he was for a week or so. Mr. Turner was picked up, as they say in South, I work in Southern Africa, and Mr. Turner was picked up, Frank was picked up, and they were in jail for a long time. You know, it was detention without trial. And so my father eventually returned. I don't know how he knew he could safely return to Crawfordville. I work in Southern Africa. I've been active in an affiliate of the National Welfare Rights Movement in Providence, Rhode Island. Worked on both Obama campaigns. So I've had a history of activism, but I'm an academic and I have to do my research and write and stuff too.
Thank you.
Wow, terrific.
Who wants to be next?
Well, I'll follow that,
Joe.
Because I fit right in. Excuse me. My name is Joe Cooney, Joseph R. There's a lot of Joe Cooneys. I was an ordained cleric in Washington, D.C. at the time of and very active in the Interracial Council demonstrations in Washington, D.C. And then when Selma happened, the group in Washington, when Dr. King asked people to come down to Selma, I was one of them that went down. And that for the second march. I didn't come back for the third march. That kind of changed a lot of things that had been planned because I was completing law school. So I came down and came, of course, to the SCOPE project and to all the orientation, Morris Brown and Rift, you know, the whole... There were just a few of us that went, well, four of us who were not particularly one college that went out to Crawfordville. And, of course, there was a lot going on. The school had been he was the principal of the high school, and Calvin Turner was the principal of the elementary school. They were the leaders in the movement. And so what the SCOPE did was help out on a lot of these things. And we used to march, of course, on all Sundays and get in. At that time, of course, it was before the Voting Rights Act, but we were doing what we could. Particularly, one of the things I did was get involved with getting the Head Start program going and greasing the skids on all of that, getting cutting the, if you can imagine, we cut tables so the kids... shortened them and put screens on the wall, and SCLC paid for the toilets we put into the school and all that. So it was a productive summer in that. But in those days we didn't have any one house. I went from the women stayed with Turner and maybe with your father.
And Mrs. Brady, Mother Brady.
Yeah. So, but I went from different houses. Every 2 or 3 weeks, we went to different places because they were fearful of putting up myself and others. So we got around as best we could, and the FBI did show up once when it was a group of us that were about to have some problems, and they did show up. It was a group, but they did arrest us, and that was a minister, He was supposed to be having a religious service at the time. We had a march going on to the courthouse for voter registration. And they actually, that was this crime that they arrested them, that their father and others for, interfering with the religious service. And that was one of the big jokes. My fellow clerics always said that I always interfered with religious service, just being present. But anyway, so I was one of the guys. They couldn't find me to arrest me because I had gone back to school, but they had a warrant out for my arrest.
Mm-hmm. A bench warrant.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Where they could shoot you on sight.
Yeah.
But anyway, the locals were very fearful of associating with us. And Frank Bates, who was going to be here today, he's going to be here hopefully. Yeah. He's at a funeral today in Crawfordville.
Mm-hmm.
Was one of the leaders of the movement, and there were many, many people arrested, including Frank, and spent a lot of time. And ultimately, the SCLC attorney from Augusta, who became a federal judge later, was the one who represented everybody. Mm-hmm. And I came back the second summer to continue the voter registration stuff and also to do something. And I was involved with trying to gather the material for a submission. And we actually submitted something to the Office of Economic Opportunity. And subsequently, the government actually funded in Crawfordville a project whereby it employed people to work. And they actually had a cooperative there making DVD, you know, T-shirts and so forth, very successfully. A cooperative was there for about 10 years, and that helped sustain the movement and, mm-hmm. and the employee to have someone employed. Only one member of the family could be employed. So it affected me because I went back and started a legal services. The University Legal Services, originally called Catholic University, because I was associated with Catholic University with another professor. And the University Legal Services is still going today. We have about 50, 55 employees, 11 of whom are attorneys, and we do. And one of the things I did after I left Crawfordville was I went and actually initiated, but sued the bishops of Lafayette, Louisiana, and Alexandria, Louisiana, to integrate the parochial schools. And at that time, and it was with the approval of the church and my superiors. So when I left the clergy, I was married by a bishop, actually officiated the services, and I was
nice.
They were very happy to see me go. But they gave me their blessing. They always supported me, by the way. When I was down there, I was supported by my order, the Dominican order. So they're very conservative, but they were very, very, always very friendly and helpful. Religiously, they're conservative, and most of the time they're socially liberal, in my day, anyway. So I don't know if that helps, but I worked very close with her father and Calvin Turner. God bless them. We should put them on the rolls because they were very heroic. They sacrificed their future. And so forth. So I was happy to be associated with the folks in Crawfordville.
And we with you.
they affected my life.
Oh,
thank you.
Good.
Okay, who would like to?
Let's go.
Okay.
Criminal.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. Jack Ruffin is the judge. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm Iris Rubin, and I was Iris Geller when in 1965. And worked in Savannah. I came to this. Yeah, tell me, because I have hearing aids, yes. So everything okay. Sounds loud to me, including mm-hmm. my own soft
Pretend
voice.
You're outside.
I come from a family background that in ways led to being involved both politically and involved in human rights. My parents were immigrants. From Russia, Jewish immigrants, and they struggled through the Depression, and after the Depression, my father was determined to get a government job, and he got a job as a post office clerk after a few years of sitting there all night long waiting for work and not getting any and not getting paid. But at any rate, he was instrumental in starting the Philadelphia local of what became the American Postal Workers Union. So I grew up, I mean, his friends were people from the post office who were in the union, so it was a very diverse group. And we lived in South Philly. You probably heard of South Philly, you know, Joey Bishop and Frankie Avalon and all of that, which was also a very diverse area. But it was divided by ethnic areas, you know. But still, we all went to school together. And I felt really very blessed to have grown up in that kind of neighborhood. Because I just didn't know the kinds of differences and prejudices that when we moved out of there that I ran into. And people would say things, and I was so offended by them. And that was good. That was a good thing to have happen. In junior high school, high school, I was very, very active, very much involved in all kinds of extracurricular activities, but very consumed by social justice. The most influential thing in my high school life, I think, was being on the debate team, where the topics were abortion, the elimination of the atomic bomb. And I met students from many other schools who, many of whom felt the way I did, more so than what I actually found at my own school. And that really influenced me. And I was out, I remember being out on a picket line with a Ban the Bomb sign. You know, I was 15. I started college. I was pretty good in math, which was pretty unusual for women. And my father said, the future's in computers, and he sent me off to Drexel University. It used to be the Institute of Drexel Institute of Technology. And I absolutely hated it. There was no one I could. It was all about fraternities, sororities, and football. there just wasn't anybody I could connect with. I just couldn't find my place in the world. So I transferred to Temple. And Temple, at that time, was still a private school, but it became a state-related school, and the tuition went way down. And I had like 35,000 students. And I found people like me. And there were organizations I could join and activities that I could take part in and things I could do in the community. The school is located in a very, very old, impoverished area. And the school was looking to expand, which meant, moving those people, chasing them out of their homes where they had lived for years. One more minute. End of that. I really, in the interim, in 64, there was Freedom Summer, and I was too young. And then there was Selma. And like so many other people, I was just moved by Selma so much, I had to do something. And then JT and Dana showed up, and they were recruiting, and the next thing I knew, I was in Savannah. or on the train to Atlanta. Savannah, had already been organized, but when we went to Americus, I really felt connected there and felt like I was really doing something worthwhile. And that it had a tremendous impact. I went back home after the summer, but then a few months later, I went to Mississippi. And that also was of great impact. What I found I was doing there was not so much the outdoor solicitation kinds of things, but, talking to people in their homes. There was already an organization that the previous, the workers who were there had worked very hard to set up. But I spent a lot of time talking to teenage girls about what they, their potential and what the world had to offer them. I spent a lot of time talking to women about becoming independent. Our attempts at a co-op were not so successful. I had no background whatsoever. I was in a social work program, and I I think that it just was a natural thing to do. That was the kind of work I was. I've kept this stuff up, even after Mississippi. I have been politically involved all of my life, no matter where I lived. North Carolina was a challenge when that legislature took over and the Republican governor got in, and there was a wonderful NAACP chapter. And there we were, 50 years later. Does anybody know Margaret Herring, who was at Freedom Summer? I met people who were in Freedom Summer. You know, we were all there. They put us down. It was the aging hippies who came out to demonstrate. These aging hippies had a great deal of impact. So anyway, I'm one of them. So that's my story. I still do stuff. I'm still very politically active.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Jesse, and I was Darlene Keeler when I was in Fort Valley. Do I do this or this? Oh, okay. When I was in Fort Valley in Peach County, Georgia. And so, pardon?
Both microphones. Keep going.
Just keep talking.
Okay, so I was with Dallas in the same, at first we were in like a barrack situation, but then later we lived in homes. But to step back a little bit, I grew up in Duluth, Minnesota, which is a very conservative, white, Christian area, and very few black people live there at all. And I remember when I was a child, there was a black person on the bus, and I asked my mother about it, and she asked me to hush, not to talk about it. So when I was at the University of Minnesota Duluth, I was studying to be a speech therapist, and I was head of the Human Relations Council, and the person, John Griffin, came to speak about Black Like Me. He was the author of the book where he made his skin black and he traveled through the South to experience what it was like to be a black man. Now, coming from a white person who wasn't exposed to black people, this really made a big impression on me. And I wanted to do something. And so afterwards, I found a group of people who were going to bring some canned goods from the University of Minnesota to the South. And it was going to be on a truck. Well, I went down to see Medgar Evers' brothers. Charles Evers was going to accept the donation in Alabama. So we get there, and Charles said, well, I've talked to Dr. King, and he thinks the best thing you can do is to go to Selma to Montgomery March. My parents had instructed me, whatever you do, do not get involved in any marches. So there was the campus minister and four other students and myself who traveled to Selma March, and it was an incredible experience to meet Dr. King outside of the Brown's Chapel and hear him speak, and it was like something that changed my life, because I was in a sorority, I was a speech therapy student, worked in a clothing store. I didn't have an awareness at all. So we went to the Selma to Montgomery March and walked hand in hand singing, We Shall Overcome. And I wasn't afraid, even though weird things happened, like white guys trying to turn our car over when we got in. But there was a naivete. I felt the right place at the right time. I had a naivete about the danger. So, but I was very impressed. When I came back, I couldn't talk to anybody in Duluth. The minister, there was nobody that understood or I could talk to, except our small little group. So I had the opportunity to go with Scope at the University of Minnesota, the big dogs, because UMD always felt like, University of Minnesota. So that's where I met Dallas and the 21 people who went
who went to
Peach County, Georgia. And I remember taking the train from Minnesota down, and it was incredible to see the economic change, to see the color change going from Minnesota, and the weather change. It was just incredible. And so we stayed in this dorm in Peach County, but then we each went to a house. And I stayed with
Miss Edna Rump, who was a beautician and worked at Fort Valley College. She fixed hair on the side. One day I asked her to fix my hair because I had real curly hair then, and she fixed it with grease and it got really fried. It looked really terrible to me. I couldn't wash it out for like weeks. But there were three things that happened while I was working as a civil rights worker in the summer of 65. I think the first was a personal awareness, like, oh my gosh, there's another whole world that I wasn't aware of. And making the connection with Ms. Rump and the children that she raised, they were not her children, but the four children she raised, to have a political awareness of the dynamics of black people. And the third was to get involved for the rest of my life. And so we did, like Dallas said, did voter registration and all of that. But later I became part of a Rainbow Coalition, which was with the Black Panthers, the Young Lords, and the Young Patriots. My husband was at CTS, and we were in the Patriot Party. And then later, I became a nurse midwife. It was a calling. And I've always worked with underserved, particularly African-American women. And then I just retired as a nurse midwife professor and an NIH researcher who did a study on, well, an intervention for African-American women at risk for depression and pregnancy. So I always have taken my beliefs and intertwined them with my academic career. So it's always influenced me every way that possible. And I've always told Ray about my time in Fort Valley and how I'd like to go back. So I connected with Willie Sneed yesterday, the guy that kind of sponsored us there, and we might go to Fort Valley to see him. So anyway, I appreciate being here.
Is there anyone else? Just one thing that Dallas mentioned when she was speaking, she wondered why the black funeral directors were always so active, and it seemed strange to her. But the fact is that in the black community, the black funeral directors were one of the groups, along with the black preachers, that were basically free from outside pressure from the white community, because the folks that went to get buried at Barnum's funeral home were going to be black. They weren't going to be white. And so throughout the South, I think it was true that the black funeral directors were, along with the black preachers, were among the people who supported the movement most strongly. In Americus, it was a black funeral home that was the center of activity, Barnum's funeral home.
They also owned their properties so that they were able to use their space without having anybody else.
They weren't renting from someone who could throw them out. So there was a real, really a reason for that. that was really important, and I think it perhaps is why Scope often looked for those people in communities. To do that. I didn't say my name. It's Boyd Faust again. But did you want to add something?
If I could share one thing. I mentioned David Dukes earlier. David wrote a book called I Have Never Lived in America.
Your name again.
My name is Joe Kiesecker. And David really wanted to be here for this. He lives in Florida still. But I just wanted to read one paragraph from that book. He's recounted in 1963 a bunch of newspaper headlines about things that are going on, and he's 16 years old. He says, each day I sat home and watched the CBS Evening News, where I saw reports of blacks being beaten, jailed, killed, and all other sorts of atrociousness in this free country, a country of which I had learned so much in my government classes. Where was the liberty and justice for all? It was a phrase I said each morning in school as I stood erect looking up at that red, white, and blue flag hanging from the ceiling, the piece of cloth that whites cared more about than the life and rights of black people. I should have ended it with liberty and justice for all whites. Then I would have been speaking the truth. And he goes on to talk about how shortly after that he decided he was going to start acting. So by himself, he went and did a sit-in at a drugstore counter at 16. He was our leader that summer.
I also might want to mention this John Hettlinger, the other people that were with us down there that aren't here besides Joe Kiesecker and myself, Michael Edwards, Claudine Boldridge, Bill Bigelow, who was on the staff of SCLC and Scope, and Pat Lewis, and Savannah Jones. Those are the people that I can remember being there with us that aren't here today, but certainly should be on any honor roll that is talking about the veterans of the Civil Rights Movement.
May I say something?
One of the stories... Oh, excuse me. I'm Selena Kiesecker, and I was... I was in Colorado working in migrant ministry during that particular summer. But one of the things that happened that I've heard about, and again I heard about in May, was when Bigelow was beaten up severely and was taken to the hospital. I think it was the county one. And during the time that he was there, one of the deputy sheriff's children was injured and needed to have a blood transfusion. So they put out a plea for persons to donate blood, and this whole group of people who were a part of the scope lined up to give blood. And the sheriff was asked, "You mean you want to have black blood in your child?" And said, "Blood is red."
Thank you.
That's another piece. Boyd Faust again. That's another piece that you brought up that many of us found in the South. In Americas, it was likewise true. As someone else has mentioned, if you were injured and you were a civil rights worker, black or white, the Sumter County Hospital would not treat you.
Wow.
They simply would not treat you. That's the reason I was taken to Atlanta when I was injured. The group from Albany, Molly spoke earlier at the open session, would often come up, and their main function was taking people to Albany to the hospital. Many times they would take people who were injured just to be seen. Bob Mullins, who is no longer with us, was the driver of a car that he told the story of having bullets in the back because they chased him all the way out of town. But that was a typical thing among, at least in rural Georgia, that if you were injured, many times the local hospital, which was white, would not treat you, or maybe they would sneak you in the back door. So it's just another one of those things that's changed.
Rural Mississippi, if somebody had an infected tooth, there was no dentist who would see them. So the way of dealing with removing a tooth was to give them lots of moonshine and get the pliers.
Mm-hmm.
It happened to me. And
your name?
My name is Iris Rubin, and I, of course, insisted upon going to a dentist, and nobody would see me, and the other white worker went with me in the car, so that we were hoping that that would do some good, and it didn't, and we finally went to an African-American dentist in Hattiesburg, and I had to go in the back door so nobody would see me come in. But you know, there were no options for medical care. It was really awful.
I wanted to mention something about Betty Harris. I wanted to mention something about escalating racial violence. You know, I grew up in Georgia, and I knew that the Klan existed, but I never saw a Klan rally until the movement started in Crawfordville. A man called Big Hat bought a house right next door to the projects, and we did some of our daily activities. You know, we would launch at the projects. So one weekend, he had a big rally. Men, women, and children were dressed in robes. A cross was burned and everything there. But I want to mention another thing that Father Cooney, or should I say Attorney Cooney? I didn't know you after the metamorphosis. So another thing that happened prior to Selma and the murder of Viola Liuzzo,
a black educator from Washington, D.C. named Lemuel Penn was killed over near Athens. He was with two other men. They had gone to Fort Benning for training, and they were driving back home. That happened before, and that really horrified us in that part of Georgia, that this could happen. You know, there are so many teachers, too, are, you know, not as independent, but they are more numerous in the black middle class, or were at that time. So to think that a fellow teacher was killed, and who was in the military, was killed in that way. I was reading about that. I've been doing some writing on Crawfordville myself, and I was reading some of the background on Lemuel Penn and how the murder occurred. They spotted them in Athens when they were changing drivers, but they followed them into another county and did what would be called a drive-by shooting today. They tried two of the men, and it was an all-white jury with a lot of Klansmen on the jury. And I think then federal charges were brought, and one of them got a longer sentence than the other. But this was when Crawfordville occurred. They had not been prosecuted. I think it was between the state prosecution and the federal one. They dressed in black. They came to Crawfordville one Sunday. They knocked you, and there's a Puerto Rican journalist, Brig. I don't remember his last name. You were knocked down by those guys. They came dressed in black to the mass meeting on the Brig courthouse. King. Okay, yes.
Brig Cable.
And so we saw an escalation of violence, white supremacy. Another group was the Hubbard brothers, the one with the backhoe. There were three or four of them, and they terrorized people. But I'm back and forth in Georgia, and I was watching TV a few years later. The oldest one, Rock, was arrested for car theft. So the establishment, white establishment, was no longer tolerating them.
One thing, they've told a lot of the story of Tolliver County and Crawfordville, and it's a very interesting story. And Betty, I'll speak with you about this, because I'm writing this story up of Crawfordville Project for Joe and for the movement and for this. But if you want to know more about Crawfordville, and they haven't even really touched on the real issue in Crawfordville, which was the school issue, when the County Board of Education, such as it was, simply closed the white high school and bused the people out of town into other counties and left the black students who wanted to transfer under freedom of choice. There was no choice because there was no other school, which led to quite an issue in September and October, and it culminated in a wonderful court case by the name of Turner versus Goolsbee. In which basically the school system was turned over into receivership to the state superintendent of education, and they more or less solved that problem. It's something to read if you're interested in what happened. The judge who wrote the opinion was very careful to write it in simple terms that anyone can read, and it doesn't miss what happened. So I recommend that one to you as well.
I just want to add one short addendum, and that is that my father later became Tolliver County Superintendent of Schools.
Yes, I did know that.
When the superintendent who had fired him had decided to retire, she contacted him. He went to Oklahoma to get his doctorate. He couldn't get a job as a principal anywhere in Georgia. So he went to Oklahoma to get his doctorate and went to Tuskegee to teach. He was involved in that enterprise in Crawfordville for a while. And he also went to Albany State to teach. And then as he was retiring from there, Lola Williams called him and asked him to asked him to run for superintendent. But Lois Richards, he had to file a lawsuit against Lois Richards because she wanted to stricken his name from the voting rolls.
She was the registrar.
He won that case and became superintendent.
How about that?
Can I add one other thing? Frank Bates. Oh, but Joe Cooney. The leader of the students was a young guy by the name of Frank Bates, who was arrested many times and brutalized, he became a lawyer and actually got a job later on working for the judge that handed down the decision in the case. It's very ironical. He's going to be here today, as I said before. He went to, I believe he's at a funeral in Crawfordville today, but the situation changed in many ways in Crawfordville. Thank you very much. You got to meet him. He's here.
Frank actually worked first, if you remember, for Goolsbee.
Yes.
Who was the prosecutor in the
That's
case.
Right.
Later did get a job with the judge, but he went after law school and called Goolsbee up one day. He tells this story better, but since he's not here, and said, I need you to show me around the courthouse in Atlanta. And Goolsbee, who had been his adversary in the court case because he was one of the plaintiffs in that case, hired him, and he worked for Goolsbee for a number of years. Another sign how things changed in Georgia after this particular summer. Mm-hmm. Who else has something they'd like to add?
I do.
Okay.
What about this paper, the family form?
I'm Selena Kiesecker, and what I would like to add is when we went to Madison, Florida in May for the town celebration of David Dukes in Madison, Florida was truly amazing, and as being my first time for visiting in that community, to hear the stories of what you all did wherever you were, the people were so appreciative because you were summer people, but you gave them, or not a but, and you gave them a special kind of courage to help them step out. Even they were staying in their own community and were still having to deal with the issues that you were being exposed to for the first time, you gave them courage to gather themselves and to speak out. And David was talking about here he was being honored in this park by the mayor, by some of the officials of the county. And as he looked out and he said, this is a park where I could not even step my foot. This is a park where I could not even sit. This is a park where I couldn't be in this pavilion. And I look across and he was naming the different buildings, establishments that were across. And he said, this happened to me in that particular one. This happened to me. This happened to other folk. We had to be there. And afterwards, people were coming up to him and saying, we didn't have the courage until you started the NAACP in our school. And then these people, as he was referring to other Joe and Bill, who were there, came down. You didn't know what you were getting into, yet you gave yourself so that all of us could be stronger. And it doesn't, when people left, yes, they were changed for a life. And the people who stayed were changed for a life. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yes, Marie.
I have to reply to that because my perspective.
Your name?
My name is Marie Gilray. I'm married to Joe Cooney. And I've heard Joe Cooney say many times that what he got was inspiration from the people who were there. And,
right.
And what he recognized was their courage. And I just can't leave that unanswered. With having been brought up in the segregated South myself, I also know the courage of the black people who lived there before you came.
Right.
And while you were there. So, you know, I just ask you to remember it was there before you got there. You enabled an awful lot, there's no question. But remember the suffering of those who were there before you were.
Yes, absolutely.
Absolutely. We were talking about it. It doesn't have to be on there.
yesterday that we're so taken with the courage of the community people. I mean, the risk that they took in having us live in their homes, you know, and associating with us and letting us eat at the dinner table with them, it was extraordinary.
Yes.
And I have to admit, we really reap the benefit of seeing many of those people run for office or take leadership and go on and do things for their, accomplish so much in their own communities. And I'm really glad you brought it up. Yeah.
May I just say one more thing? And that is that the people from Skokie who came to Clarksville were the first white friends of the people, of the black people. And that made a big difference.
Okay, Dallas Lindgren. Just for, in Fort Valley, at first we were in this common building, and then they thought, oh, you should live with families. And the families were afraid to take us. So there was one family took in two students. The wife and the children moved elsewhere. The father and one son stayed in the home. Sometimes wouldn't be there because they didn't know what was going to happen. Everything was okay, though.
Joe Kiesecker, a story out of Mississippi the summer before in a rural area north of Canton, Mississippi, called Valley View. And a story, the final part of it, didn't hear until last summer when we were back visiting that community and talking with the son of one of the prominent black farmers who helped provide leadership to the movement. And it was a story of how he was stopped, his family was stopped. He was driving, they were stopped at night by the sheriff's deputy, a couple of them, along the county road, and it was pretty clear their intention was to shoot him. And he ran into the forest. Mississippi's pretty heavily wooded in much of it, and got away from them, and managed to work his way around and finally get back to the house. This was in part because he was helping provide the leadership before we got there and after we left, and because his family and his brother's family were both housing civil rights workers. We were stopped on the road one day. I was in the pickup with him. I was sitting in the middle and another civil rights worker on the right-hand side, both of us white, and deputy sheriff stopped us. And the deputy sheriff got out of his car and approached the pickup on the driver's side and talked to him. Of course, he knew him because they'd been harassing him forever, right? Asked him what he was doing, that sort of thing, but didn't go any further than that. And I was sitting there praying that that deputy sheriff would not open that pickup door, because the butt of Buddy Froney's rifle was against my leg and the barrel was pointed at the door. And as he pointed out, you people pledge nonviolence to be here. We live here. We haven't made that pledge.
Thank you, everyone. It's 1 o'clock, so we're going to have to stop at this point if we want to get any lunch before the next thing starts.
Oh, yeah.
There will be another breakout session this afternoon, and I'm assuming it's going to be essentially the same groups with different questions to discuss.
Okay. Yeah, different.
There will be different groups? Okay, sorry about that. But I think this has been very helpful, and I appreciate everybody's remembrances and stories and the way they talk about this. So I guess we'll go to lunch now.
If you, look at the pictures, I've been charged to identify them. So if you see a picture and I haven't spoken to you, would you please see me and say, oh, number one?
This is the recording of Georgia Group 2 at the end. The people whom I were talking to, Judy, for example, and they all called him Joe because he told them, call me Joe,
and
though he ran around with his collar on
Judy
all the time.
Judy was in grad school at the time. She was, I guess, late 20s,
yes,
early 30s.
She was the oldest person.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And then Candy and Weber.
She's passed away. She passed away. So Candy,
a few years ago,
I think. I'm not sure exactly.
Oh, sorry.
Tomorrow there will be a memorial thing, and I think Joe will indicate when these people passed away. Mm-hmm. But Candy is gone, and so it was really left Judy and Joe, and we don't know what happened to Richard. So no one
Yay,
even seems
Richard.
To... Richard Copeland.
There was also a guy... I saw, is it Bill Traynor, in the elevator, uh-huh. and I vaguely remember him. There was a guy beaten up on Lexington Street.
That was Richard, wasn't it? Or wasn't Richard the one who was in, on Lexington Street? Now, which way does Lexington Street run?
It was around the curve just before you get to Alexander
Okay, what's the street that runs between the courthouse and Bonner's Cafe? What's that main street?
Oh, that's I don't know what it is. That's the one that goes down to the Stevens.
It eventually goes down to the bar.
It intersects with uh-huh. that. Lexington okay. intersects yes. with that. But I have another name. I have notes with me.
Oh, wonderful.
I'll look at
Please
the notes.
Do. Love to hear that.
Because Tony Scruton.
Okay, Tony was an SCLC staff person. He was beaten up actually right outside of the cafe, I think. Yes, and then they took him home after the second time because
was he hurt badly?
And I don't think so, but I think, you know, he had become a target.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's just when the SCLC staff people became a target, if you weren't Willie Bolden,
mm-hmm,
then
mm-hmm.
or J.T. Johnson mm-hmm, in the first part and then mm-hmm. Willie in the second part, then you know that it will, and particularly white staff persons were not really safe.
Okay, what about James Gibson?
James Gibson, when did he? I have his name.
Do you remember when Andy Young came?
Mm-hmm.
You know, he came to talk about what to do about the sheriff appointment. You know.
Yeah. Oh yeah, the lovely sheriff.
But that's he came to resolve that conflict.
Yeah.
Because the folks didn't like the idea of having anything to do with the sheriff. But Andy Young said, we want more blacks.
Well, you mean the chief of police.
Just give him a gun, right?
Yeah, just...
You meant the chief of... Jesse was his first name. Was it Owen?
Meadows, I think.
Jesse Meadows. Jesse Meadows. Yeah, last of the week.
Right.
Well, you said he never did any harm, but he's the person that arrested Frank.
Oh, he arrested Frank?
He arrested Frank the first act when he became sheriff.
Oh,
he arrested
okay,
Frank for encouraging a boycott against, I don't know which store it was. I think it was the Shoemaker or some store there. Frank was saying, don't go in there and buy anything. And Meadows arrested him and threw him in jail. So Frank doesn't have real good memories of Jesse Meadows.
Mm-hmm, uh-huh. I didn't know that happened. But we were picketing the whole front
yes,
street.
Right.
So I don't know why any, you know,
well, I heard,
it was trumped up, of course.
Well, because Frank was seen to be the leader.
He was the
leader of mm-hmm, these people. Mm-hmm. They picked him, just like of all of those people that marched to the church that day,
mm-hmm,
of the famous interfering with divine worship mm-hmm, arrests, mm-hmm, they picked people like Joe mm-hmm, and Calvin and mm-hmm, your dad mm-hmm, and I think your grandfather. Was it your, no, it's Calvin's father. It was Calvin's father.
Uh-huh.
And Frank's grandfather, who mm-hmm. had never been
Grandpa
inside.
Grandpa Joe.
Yeah, Grandpa
who had
Joe.
Supported Goldwater.
Exactly.
And,
oh,
but
my gosh.
Well, there was one
of course,
day,
it was Republican. Well, they were the good guys.
Calvin has a... Yeah, he's, God bless him, he's gone now. Calvin has a story. He said, I never saw me move as fast as one day when we grew up.